that hymn, Jesus, Thy Blood and Righteousness, is written by Count von Zinzendorf, the founder of the Moravian movement. Now, if you know anything about the Moravians, the interesting thing is John Wesley, when he was coming back from America on a ship, met some of the Moravian missionaries. And it was those Moravians and their faith in the midst of a great storm that actually led John Wesley to faith in Jesus Christ. It was through their work. And so here John Wesley has translated the hymns, the words of this German hymn written by Count von Zinzendorf, one of the leaders of the Moravians, into English. So very interesting old hymn. But it speaks of Jesus as our blood and righteousness, and that's what we'll talk about in Job this morning as we look at Job speaking about what righteousness is and how we obtain it and what the difference between God's righteousness and our righteousness is. Some of the interesting things about that. All right, we are starting this morning in Job chapter 25, a rather short chapter, which we left off with last week. We hadn't gotten to that chapter quite. I meant to finish chapter 25 last week, but we didn't quite have time. Now, we've been going through Job. There's been a series of discussions going on, discourses from three of Job's friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. And we had two groups of three rounds where one of the men would speak and Job would answer and so forth. We're in the third round, and we're at the second speaker, who is Bildad the Shuhite. Now, these men, as you recall, represent together a kind of orthodoxy, the orthodox view, and they're trying to counsel his friend, where you might think of Eliphaz as the apologist in the midst. He's the thinker, the man who has that kind of a view of things. And Bildad would be more the orthodox man who comes and says, this is the way tradition, this is what tradition says, this is the way we've always done it, what we've always believed, and therefore it must be true. Whereas the third, Zophar, was the he was the man who would just stand up and say dogmatically, this is the way things are. And unfortunately, none of these three men seemed to be able to help Job very much. In fact, their counsel was oftentimes exactly the opposite of what Job needed and was not even speaking very clearly concerning what God was doing. Well, this morning we'll take a look at the last of those discourses, a very short one from Bildad, and then we'll hear a long answer from Job. Job's final words. Job's done talking when he's finished with this speech this morning. So we'll hear, first of all, what Bildad has to say. Chapter 25, verse 1 of Job. Then Bildad, the Shuhite, answered and said, dominion and fear belong to him. He makes peace in his high places. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not rise? How then can man be righteous before God? Or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? If even the moon does not shine and the stars are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is a maggot and the son of man who is a worm? Wow, what a wonderful... I'm sure Job just felt wonderful hearing that. That's a real upper there. Let's talk, though, a little about what he's saying here, just so we don't miss it. First of all, in verses 2 and 3 there, he's speaking about the sovereignty and power of God. Dominion belongs to God. Is he right? Right. Ultimately, he's right. However, here on earth, we don't see that yet. We still see a world that is ruled by Satan in many ways, temporarily. One day, God will rule here. Dominion and fear belong to God, so God rules over all. Now, actually, there is an encouraging side to that thought, though Job wasn't encouraged by hearing this. What's the encouraging side to that thought? It's the expression which I think you need to give to many people who are suffering, and that is, God is still on the throne. Ultimately, God is on the throne. Even if we face evil days here, we must remember that God is still on the throne. That hasn't changed. He hasn't been dethroned. He still rules. This should be an encouragement to us in the midst of our troubles. So in a sense, Bildad could have taken this to be an encouragement, could have gone on and encouraged Job with these words, but he did not. Now, secondly, it says God makes peace. He makes peace in his high places. And when you think about it, that's what Jesus had also. Remember when the disciples were out there on that stormy Sea of Galilee? It was Jesus who calmed the waves, who stopped the wind, who made it peaceful for them. And that's the way it is. God is the only one who can stop the winds, who can calm the rough seas when our lives are in a real turmoil. And it is true of God that he's the only one who can do that. He makes peace in his high places. Now, God has unlimited power and resources. He goes on and talks about that in the next verse. Is there any number to his armies? That is, can his armies be counted? They're beyond counting. He has every resource available to him. And we forget that sometimes because we look from our human perspective and we say, what could God do in this situation? Well, if you've got unlimited resources, as God does, God can do something in any situation. So we need to be understanding that. But more than that, when we think about God's power, we must also realize that God is not out to destroy us. God is out to help us. And too many times, this sovereignty of God, as it's spoken of in our traditional theology of our mainline denominations, has become a sort of a fearful thing where we have the sense that God is out to get us. And I think that that's why many of those mainline denominations have stopped teaching the sovereignty of God, because that's what it always turned into. It turned into God is out to get us. And he's not. He is out to get us only in the sense that he wants us for himself. That's the only sense he's out to get us. He's not out to destroy us. Notice he says here, upon whom does his light not rise? That is, God is always on the high ground. God's light always rises on us. He has the high ground. He has the heavenly position. And his light rises on us. Our light doesn't rise on him. Remember, there's that verse from 1 John, which is always encouraging to me. God is light. In him there is no darkness at all. See, sometimes we're tempted to think that God is dark, that God doesn't have our benefit in mind. And that's not true. He's light. He's transparent. He's beautiful. But let's move on. Verses 4 and 5 speak about the unrighteousness of man. How then can man be righteous before God, or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? This is speaking to a truth which again is common in theology, called the total depravity of man. Now this is a really scary truth. Not the one you want to be telling Job right at this moment. He didn't need to hear about this. It's true. We're born with this sin nature. We inherit it from our parents. It's passed down from generation to generation, and from the very time we're born, we have this tendency toward rebellion against God. And what he's saying, as he goes on in verse 5, even the lights of the night sky, and if we think of ourselves as a light in the darkness because we're somehow righteous, I think that's what he's trying to say to Job. Job, you think of yourself as a light in the darkness. Well, look at the moon and the stars. Even their light is flickering and imperfect. And even God looks upon that, he says, as being impure. I'm not sure if that's really true. Some of the wisdom here isn't really the what it seems to be. But he goes on and concludes then his whole argument saying, how much less man who is a maggot and the son of man who is a worm. Is he right? Compared to God, we are nothing. But what is the one thing which makes us, what is our one answer as Christians to this particular thought? Because this is the way much philosophy comes to also. The existential philosophy ends up with this very negative perspective on the universe. Man is nothing. He's a maggot. The famous work of existential philosophy is entitled Nausea. It's literally what the title is. So what's our answer? I can do all things through Christ. More than that, though, even though man is a maggot, Jesus came as a man. As a man. He came to earth as a human being like us. And so while we may be maggots, the amazing thing is that God came and humbled himself and became one of us. He came fully man, fully God, but fully man. He came as one of us. And that's the amazing thing for us as Christians. We don't have to have this negative view that says, I'm just a worm. We can also say, but God came in the flesh. And that's amazing. That's amazing. And it's our answer to this kind of negative philosophy that he brings. Well, now the three friends are done speaking. And thank goodness, I've heard enough of them. And Job has heard enough of them because he doesn't give him a chance to speak again. He's going to go right on, and he has some important things to say. Let's look, first of all, here at chapter 26, see what he has to say here. But Job answered and said, "How then have you helped him who is without power? How have you saved the arm that has no strength? How have you counseled one who has no wisdom? And how have you declared sound advice to many? To whom have you uttered words, and whose spirit came from you?" As I said before, these men represent orthodoxy. And the problem with orthodoxy is when it's faced with a new situation, with a situation like Job's, there is no answer. And quite frankly, if the church is seen as being irrelevant, it's because that kind of orthodoxy which Job's three friends represent is in many cases irrelevant today for some of the issues that people are dealing with. It's particularly irrelevant to suffering if it doesn't include the love of God. You see, that was the problem with the church at Ephesus. They were as orthodox as could be, and they knew how to detect heresy, and they would speak against heresy. But what was the church at Ephesus missing there in Revelation? They had left their first love, their love for God. And that's what happens with many of the Orthodox. They left their first love. And that's what Job is saying right here. Where's the love? Is this the way you're helping me? Is this the way you're counseling me? You see, Christian counsel is important. It's important that we be able to counsel one another, to encourage one another. It speaks of that in Hebrews, that we need to be encouraging one another daily, that we need to be gathering together and not failing to do that, and we need to be doing that so we can spur one another on to good works. But that's encouragement, not discouragement, and that's what his friends have brought. Let's move on, though. Verses 5 through 7 there speak of God's light shining in the darkness. He's going to go to that issue since that's what Bildad was talking about. "The dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting them. Sheol is naked before him, and destruction has no covering. He stretches out the north over empty space. He hangs the earth on nothing." You see, he talks here about the darkness of death. Death is a very dark thing. The dead tremble, those under the waters and those inhabiting him. He's speaking of those who are in Sheol, the place of the dead. He's saying they're in a dark place. And then there's the darkness of desolation. Sheol is naked before him. Sheol is thought to be the place of the dead. It is a place of utter desolation. And destruction has no covering. That is, that if we think of death as leading to destruction, and that's the world's way of thinking of death, the world's way of thinking apart from God says, when you die, that's it. You're nothing. That's the world's way of thinking. And it's a very desolate thing, and that's a very dark kind of desolation there that exists. But he says, you know the interesting thing? He says, do you know that God built this universe on emptiness? If you look up towards the North Star, one of the interesting things is there's a spot which, even with powerful telescopes up around the North Star, where there are almost no other stars. It's almost completely dark. Up around Polaris, it's kind of an odd spot in the night sky. There's just nothing there. And he's speaking of something which is interesting here. It says he stretches out the north over empty space. He hangs the earth on nothing. What's kind of odd about that statement? Given when Job wrote this a long time ago, almost every culture had some sort of a myth that the earth was set on something. Whether it be Hercules in the Greek myth holding up the earth, or whether it be the Indians had a big elephant that held up earth, two elephants or something that held up the earth. All of the other cultures had theories of something holding up the earth. But he speaks of the earth being set in nothingness. Somehow, God had given him an understanding that the earth is sitting in the middle of space, in the middle of nothingness. It's not set on something, but is set in nothingness. Amazing for his time. But he's also speaking here philosophically the fact that the earth is sitting in darkness. That God brought light into the darkness, order out of chaos. That's what Genesis chapter 1 is all about. Bringing order out of chaos, light into darkness, separating light from darkness, separating waters above and below. He's going to go on to talk about that next couple of verses here. He binds up the water in his thick clouds, yet the clouds are not broken under it. He covers the face of his throne and spreads his cloud over it. You remember that's one of the first things that happened in creation. He created a firmament in the midst of the waters that separated the waters below from the waters above. This little, we call it the biosphere, that place where all life exists between the highest clouds and the depths of the ocean is where all life exists here on earth. It's a relatively narrow layer. But God created that, and he separated the water above from the water below. And then the interesting thing is, as he did that separation, those clouds, as it were, cover the place of his throne. If his throne is in the heavens, he has covered them with clouds. There's a lot of talk about clouds in Deuteronomy, where we begin to understand that that's what kept the people from being destroyed as God appeared there at Mount Sinai. It was the clouds that veiled him, because if the clouds hadn't veiled him, they'd have seen God face to face and they would have died. They would have been destroyed immediately. Sometimes God's clouds save us, lest we see his face too fully. We're not ready to see his face. He drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of the light and darkness. Again, he has an insight, I think, having looked on the moon. He understood something about the earth. We call it, from space, you see that beautiful line, that arc on the face of the earth. Somehow he knew that that arc existed, at just as it does on the moon. And we've seen that from space. We call it the Terminator, that separation between darkness and light that is so clearly visible from outer space. But somehow he knew about that as he looked at the moon. He had an idea that the earth had the same thing. Again, far ahead of his time. Verses 11 and 12, the pillars of heaven tremble and are astonished at his rebuke. He stirs up the sea with his power, and by his understanding he breaks up the storm. You see, God reigns in heaven and on earth, he's saying. And one of the problems we have, there was an interesting article in Sunday's paper about the concept of God and some surveys that were made concerning the concept of God. And many people have a concept that God is distant, that God lives way out there, that he doesn't do much here on earth, and that he doesn't care much for us here on earth, that he's just a distant God. Many people have that kind of a view of God. But Job says, that's the problem with your argument, Bildad, is that you have the view of God as being distant, as being way up there and having it in for us down here. But he says, God not only rules up there, God also rules down here. And it's demonstrated in the fact that he can break up the storm. He can stir up the sea, and God does that sometimes, but he can also break up the storm. Yeah. Yeah, there's some... Yeah, Hebrew, that is... the word for storm is actually the word Rahab. And so, again, sometimes these Hebrew texts, especially the poetic ones, are a little difficult to interpret as to whether that's to be taken as a name or as an object. Yeah. And so that's one of those confusing... One of the things to understand when you read our English translation of the Hebrew Bible is there are many fewer words in Hebrew than there are in English. They leave out a lot of words in Hebrew, and so there are these very short sentences, and you've got to interpret what they mean when there are all of these words that we would have in English that are missing. And you've got to put in the missing words and figure out what they are, just as in Hebrew they don't write vowels, and you have to put in the missing vowels. Figure out what the words are. Now, fortunately, they're usually unique, but there's only one set of consonants that you can, one way to put the vowels into the consonants, usually. Not always. But anyway, that's probably where that comes, that alternate translation. Yeah. I don't know which is right. I kind of like this one in the New King James better. There's a footnote in the New King James saying that that's the word Rahab there for a storm. Verse 13, by his spirit he adorned the heavens, his hand pierced the fleeing serpent. Indeed, these are the mere edges of his ways, and how small a whisper we hear of him, but the thunder of his power, who can understand? That is to say, God is at work. First of all, his spirit creates beauty. We see that in Romans chapter 8 also. Let me just read that to you. It's a beautiful passage. I'm sure you all are familiar with it. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. See, the Holy Spirit brings out a glory in us that we don't even know is there. When the Holy Spirit is working in us, He makes things beautiful, just as He does here in verse 13. For the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of Him who subjected it in hope, because creation itself will also be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves inwardly, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of our body. For we were saved in this hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For why does one still hope for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we eagerly wait for it with perseverance. Likewise, the Spirit also helps in our weaknesses. For we do not know what we should pray as we ought, but the Spirit Himself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered. Now he who searches the heart knows what the mind of the Spirit is, because he makes intercession for the saints according to the will of God. And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. Those are verses we know very familiar, and we'll be studying probably this Sunday as we go through Romans. But those are words that speak of this same kind of thing, of the Spirit creating beauty. Now, it says his hand pierced the fleeing serpent. What's that speaking of? Who is the serpent? Satan. God has Satan on the run. God has Satan on the run, and that's been true from the beginning of creation. That's why the Spirit was hovering over the waters there in Genesis 1:1, because there was chaos here, because Satan was here. And he was hovering over the waters saying, we can't let this chaos remain. There must be something here. We need to put order here. And so the Spirit began that work as he brooded over the waters. The Spirit began the work that which would eventually be the undoing of Satan. Indeed, these are the mere edges of his ways, and how small a whisper we hear of them. That is, we just barely understand what God is doing. He's revealed just enough of what he's doing for us to understand in a broad sense what it is that God is doing. Now, the problem with much of the theology, which talks a lot about the sovereignty of God and argues about the sovereignty of God, is that it claims to understand his power, God's power, but it doesn't understand God's power. It misunderstands God's power. So be very careful when people start arguing things on the basis of the sovereignty of God. That's Reformed theology, especially ultra-Reformed theology. It's very much into arguments from the sovereignty of God, that it's impossible for anyone to not be saved if the Word of God has been shared effectively with them, that kind of thing. That there's no need for evangelism because God will save who God will save, and that's all there is to it. Well, be careful. When you're arguing about the sovereignty and power of God, you're arguing about something that you don't fully understand, that I don't fully understand, that no one here fully understands. Let's not put God in a box by claiming we understand how his power will be exercised, because he exercises it in ways we can't understand at all. We have a general outline from the scriptures of how God is working, but we don't know all the details. So let's be careful about that. So anyway, Job is looking up to God. And that's a really good thing, incidentally, that after this answer, which should have left Job kind of groveling in the dust, if he thought, I'm a worm, a maggot, he didn't. Instead, he looked up to God. He said, well, yeah, but God is at work doing good things. God's working in wonderful ways here on the earth. But let's look at righteousness, because that's the subject, really, of this last discourse. And he continues with that in chapter 27. Moreover, Job continued his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me, and the breath of God in my nostrils. I love that, the contrast there. First of all, he says, God's made my soul bitter and he's taken away my justice. Then turns right around and says, but he did give me breath. And every breath I breathe is a gift from God. My lips shall not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say you are right till I die. I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. My heart shall not reproach me as long as I live." Now, we need to understand something here. Job is a little bit self-righteous at this point, but more importantly, we won't understand what he's talking about unless we understand that he's talking about the righteousness that comes from God. And that's the theme in the book of Romans, as you remember. And the big issue in the book of Romans is that you understand that though we have no righteousness, there is a righteousness we have that comes from God, a righteousness that comes by faith. And as we bear God's righteousness, we must give testimony that his righteousness is ours. And I think that's what Job is saying here. He's saying, I'm not righteous on my own, but I'm going to uphold God's righteousness because by faith, that's the righteousness I have. Not my own righteousness, but God's righteousness imputed to me. In a sense, he is one of those Old Testament believers who is looking forward to Christ and has an understanding that righteousness comes as we look forward to Messiah and his work and put faith in him. He goes on, though, in verses 7 through 10 to talk more. May my enemy be like the wicked, and he who rises up against me like the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the hypocrite? Though he may gain much if God takes away his life. Will God hear his cry when trouble comes upon him? Will he delight himself in the Almighty? Will he always call on God? Now, it's very interesting. We were just talking about how he's a little bit self-righteous in that first statement. But what he's saying here in the second statement, which makes it clear that he's not talking about his own righteousness, he's saying, if you are a hypocrite, if you are one who claims what isn't yours, claims to be righteous when you aren't righteous, you know, pretends to be the ostrich, buries his head in the sand and says, I'm righteous, there's nothing, no sin in my life. He's saying, well, the hypocrite will get what they deserve. They will be like the wicked because that's really what they are. And if I were a hypocrite, Job is saying in verse 9, then God wouldn't hear my cry when trouble comes upon me. Job is saying, I think at this point, I know God has heard my cry. I haven't seen the answer yet, but God has heard my cry. And Job is delighting himself in the Almighty. Job is always calling on God because that's what he just affirmed in the first paragraph, is that he would keep calling on God. He would keep calling out to God because God is righteous and God will give him his justice. So we need to be careful about claiming what isn't ours. Sometimes out in the world when we are under attack, we begin to claim a righteousness that isn't ours, that we have no right to claim. And it doesn't help. What we must claim is the only righteousness we have is his righteousness that is imputed to us through the washing by the blood of Jesus Christ, that we are sinners saved by grace. Verse 11, I will teach you about the hand of God. What is with the Almighty I will not conceal. Surely all of you have seen it. Why then do you behave with complete nonsense? Job is going to teach them about God. And you know, that's an important thing. That's what counsel, Christian counsel, is to be all about. We are to be teaching each other about God, not attempting to take control of each other's lives. Unfortunately, that's the trap many counselors fall into, but helping to teach other people about God, directing people always to God. Even when we are praying with people, the thing we always need to emphasize is you can go directly to God also. I'd love to pray with you, but remember that you can always go directly to God. You don't come praying through somebody else. But the kind of interesting thing, and these verses are interesting, he says, I will teach you about the hand of God. One of the important things that's going on in this last portion of Job is Job must come to the realization that he needs to be teachable, because it's when Job is teachable, when he's ready to listen to God, that Job has come to the end of himself. And that's the same for us. Oftentimes we're so busy teaching other people that we're not in a place where God can teach us. I know any of us who open God's word find that immediately. If it doesn't teach me, if I'm not ready to hear what it's saying to me, then I'm not ready to share anything with you. I'm not in the place where God wants me to be. Elihu, who we will look at next week, talks at length about that. And that's the difference with Elihu and those three friends. The three friends said, Job, you must be a horrible sinner, and that's why you're suffering. You must have done something back there that was just horrible, and God is getting you for it. Whereas Elihu says, your problem is right now, Job. Your attitude is wrong toward God. You're not ready to hear what God is saying. You're not ready for what God is doing through this, because God is working for good through this, and you're not ready to hear what His good is. So when your attitude is right, when you're teachable, then you're going to be ready for God to speak to you. And that's what happens at the end of Elihu's speech. But anyway, let's move on in this section. He's going to talk about the portion of the wicked. And Job is going to admit, with his three friends, that the portion of the wicked is not a good thing. This is the portion of a wicked man with God and the heritage of oppressors received from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword. And his offspring shall not be satisfied with bread. Those who survive him shall be buried in death, and their widows shall not weep. Though he heaps up silver like dust and piles up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the just will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. He builds a house like a moth, like a booth which a watchman makes when they used to, in their fields, in their agricultural work, one of the first things you did when you were establishing a field outside the city, that's where the fields were, they were outside the walled cities, the first thing you had to do was to build a watchtower to keep the animals and to keep other people out of your crops. So the first thing you did when you were getting a field going outside the walls was to build a watchtower. And these are the booths which the watchman makes, especially at harvest season. You lived out there in those watchtowers, in those booths, because you had to stay with your crops so they didn't get stolen. It's almost like a scarecrow, but you have to be there personally. The rich man will lie down, but not be gathered up. He opens his eyes, and he is no more. Terrors overtake him like a flood. A tempest steals him away in the night. The east wind carries him away, and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls against him and does not spare. He flees desperately from its power. Men shall clap their hands at him and shall hiss him out of his place. So he's speaking here, very interesting, of the futility of self-reliance. I don't know if you've ever listened to some of the health, wealth, and prosperity teachers, or even some of the very popular teachers of our day. I was listening to Joel Osteen, or whatever his name is, the other evening. I just happened across him on television and thought, I wonder what he actually has to say. So I listened for a little while, and he was the same way. It was, you know, you can do this, and you can be all that God wants you to be, and you can, and he goes on and on with this kind of, but he's talking about self-reliance. He's not talking about relying on God, and that is what makes a man wicked, when they rely on themselves and not on God. What he's picturing here in a beautiful way is the fall of the self-made man. And that's what he's picturing here. Everything that this man has built up for himself comes tumbling down. And that's the great fear here on earth. You talk about it with people, for instance, who are strong. And the problem with a person who is strong, whether that be political power or physical strength, is eventually somebody comes along who's more politically powerful or more physically strong than you are, and you're no longer number one. That's inevitable. And what he's saying in here is, if you're relying on yourself, eventually you will fall. If you're a self-made man, eventually you're going to be destroyed, because that's wickedness before God. So righteousness comes by faith in God and not through any other way. Let's move on then to chapter 28. This we've been talking about as being the first of the books of the wisdom literature. And quite frankly, this business of Christian counsel, Job's three friends trying to counsel him, Job trying to explain how their counsel is lacking in wisdom, is all about this subject of wisdom. And so Job, as he finishes answering Bildad, finally gets into the heart of the matter. What's wisdom all about? Where do we find it? What's wisdom all about? And so he talks about it here. First, he's going to give us the picture of miners as they search for things. Surely there is a mine for silver, and a place where gold is refined, iron is taken from the earth, and copper is smelted from ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches every recess for ore in the darkness and the shadow of death. He breaks open a shaft away from people in places forgotten by feet. They hang far away from men and swing to and fro. As for earth, from it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the source of sapphires, and it contains gold dust. That path no bird knows, nor has the falcon's eye seen it. The proud lions have not trodden it, nor has the fierce lion passed over it. He puts his hand on the flint. He overturns the mountains at the roots. He cuts out channels in the rocks, and his eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams from trickling. What is hidden he brings forth to light. You see, this is the human concept of what wisdom was all about. They say it's like digging for gold. And you must dig a mine deep into the earth until you find where that vein of gold is. And if you're wise enough to know where to look for that vein of gold, then you can have all of that gold. And the worldly view of wisdom says that's the way it is with wisdom. If you'll just dig deep into the knowledge and understanding, you'll eventually find wisdom. For instance, when I was involved in doing mathematics, I was always very concerned with the foundations of mathematics, getting to the most underlying ideas, to the basic principles that underlie mathematics, mathematical logic and things like that, because I felt if you could just get into that, you could understand where the problems are and you could understand what was keeping you from proving certain theorems that are way up here, because the problem is really way down here. There's something wrong in your set of assumptions for doing your mathematics. That is, like these miners, you're always going down to the foundation, to the roots of the mountains, the foundation of the mountains, he's saying. That's the human idea of where we find wisdom, that it's deep. These are the deep truths. And be careful, because people will oftentimes come to you, many of those who are heretics, and say, we have the deep truths. Just come to us and we'll tell you those deep secrets that are way down there that you need to understand about life. We have that deep secret. Job, though, has an answer to that. Verse 12 and following, he answers this. He says, but where can wisdom be found? Is it found down deep somewhere under all these ideas? And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its value, nor is it found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me, and the sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be purchased for gold, nor can silver be weighed for its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in the precious onyx or sapphire. Neither gold nor crystal can equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewelry of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or quartz, for the price of wisdom is above rubies. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. There's an interesting verse which I think parallels this. We read here, first of all, he's saying, where can it be found? And he's saying, no, it cannot be found in the depths. And where is the place of understanding? And we need to know what that place is, because we'd like to be in that place of having understanding. We'd like to find this wisdom. It's interesting. Verse 13 almost seems out of place. Man does not know its value, nor can it be found in the land of the living. And that verse, does that seem out of place to any of you? A little like a non sequitur there. I want to tell you what I think it's saying, which puts it back in place. He's saying that wisdom, obtaining wisdom, it will cost you your life. And this is not actually a foreign idea to us. It comes, Jesus himself expressed it. You remember after Peter's affirmation that Jesus was the Messiah, Jesus said, you know, I'm going to the cross. And Peter said, no, you aren't. That wouldn't make any sense. And Jesus replies at that point in Matthew 16:23, but he turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but of the things of men. You see, Peter was speaking from human wisdom, that kind of wisdom that you dig deep for. And Peter felt he understood something about Jesus and where he was going, but he didn't. Then Jesus said to his disciples, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man will come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will reward each according to his works. Assuredly, I say to you, there are some standing here who shall not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. But the important thing there is that he says, if you would have wisdom, true wisdom, it will cost you your life. If you want to follow Jesus, you have to take up your cross and follow him daily. It will cost you your life. True wisdom will cost your life. It's not in the land of the living. It's in the land of those who have died to the flesh, as we've been talking about in Romans, and are living for the Spirit. Not living according to the flesh, but living according to the Spirit. That's the only way you can find wisdom, and I think that's what he's saying in this particular passage. It's not in the depths. He emphasizes that. Verses 15 through 19 talk about the cost of it, just as Jesus said, if you had everything in the world, you couldn't buy this salvation. Likewise with wisdom, if you have everything in the world, nothing will suffice to buy wisdom. You should remind your kids of that when they are running up huge debts to get a college education. You won't buy wisdom this way. In fact, my daughters are getting up, and they're in their high school years now, so I'm having to prepare them for college. I'm going to have to prepare them saying, you know, they're going to tell you they're giving you wisdom there and that you're paying these huge prices to get wisdom, but you won't get wisdom there. You can't buy wisdom, in fact. It costs more than that. And education won't get you wisdom. So where do you get wisdom? Verse 20, from where then does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Destruction and death say, we have heard a report about it with our ears. God understands its way, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees under the whole heavens to establish a weight for the wind and apportion the waters by measure. When he made a law for the rain and a path for the thunderbolt, when he saw wisdom, then he saw wisdom and declared it. He prepared it. Indeed, he searched it out. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So we see several things here about wisdom. First of all, it is God's wisdom. That's the most important thing to understand from here. Wisdom comes from God, and that's something God owns, and if we're going to find it, we have to go to God. First of all, it's not earthly. It's not found anywhere here on earth. So you won't find it by digging around here on earth. He's already emphasized that in the previous verses. But it says that God knows wisdom, and it's inherent. We can see God's wisdom revealed in creation. Because God, as he was creating this world, his wisdom is revealed through many of the things he has created. That wisdom is visible in creation, and yet that's not where we find wisdom. In fact, though, God gives us simple directions, and this simple directions of verse 28 is what you find over in Proverbs, what you find in Ecclesiastes, what you find even in the Psalms, the same direction as what you find here. And to man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. The fear of the Lord. Living in the fear of the Lord, that's the beginning of wisdom. That's where wisdom starts. Living constantly, knowing that God is present, that God sees everything I do, that God is at work in my life. That's living in the fear of the Lord. Living with a reverence for God. And that's the very thing that's missing today in so many churches, is a reverence for God. Living in the fear of the Lord. And that's why we have a lack of wisdom, because we have a lack of the fear of the Lord. But he says there's another part to this. It's just like the part, just like the message of Jesus Christ, you have to depart from evil before you have understanding. That is, repentance is a necessary part of wisdom. And in fact, the fear of the Lord could be thought of as living under God's rule, which makes this verse sound, translate to being very much like the gospel which Jesus Christ brought at first. Repent, for the kingdom of God is at hand. So that wisdom which we are seeking, that God's wisdom, which is far above man's, is a wisdom that comes as we live in the fear of the Lord, and as we depart from evil, as we repent of sin. But let's go on. Job is going to reminisce a little bit here about the golden years. And many of us, as we get older, look back fondly at the years past, just as Job will right here. So let's look at this and see what he has to say. Job further continued his discourse and said, "Oh, that I were as in months past, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone upon my head, and when his light, by his light, I walked through darkness, just as in the days of my prime, when the friendly counsel of God was over my tent, when the Almighty was yet with me, when my children were round me, when my steps were bathed with cream, and the rock poured out rivers of oil for me." He's living in his past glory, and he's saying, oh, that we could have those past glories. But what was it that made Job's life glorious in those days? God was at work in his life in a special way, and he could see it then. Right now he's having trouble seeing that, but that's what makes our lives glorious, and if there is a glory about the past, it's that God has been at work in our past. That's what makes it glorious. Let's move on, though, and see what else he has to say here. He's going to talk about wise living, and we need to understand what that's about. Verse 7, "When I went out to the gate by the city, when I took my seat in the open square, the young men saw me and hid, and the aged arose and stood. The princes refrained from talking and put their hand on their mouth. The voice of nobles was hushed, and their tongue stuck to the roof of their mouth. When the ear heard, then it blessed me. When the eye saw, then it approved me." I think of him in these verses as being a little like E.F. Hutton. You remember those old E.F. Hutton commercials? E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen. Yes. Well, when Job came around, people listened. Job had a lot to say, and he blessed a lot of people. He was a wise man, and he spoke with great wisdom, and he had a lot of respect. Because, why did he have respect? Verse 12, "Because I delivered the poor who cried out, the fatherless and the one who had no helper. The blessing of a perishing man came upon me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind, and I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor, and I searched out the case that I did not know. I broke the fangs of the wicked and plucked the victim from his teeth." So here's the interesting thing about what it means to be upright. Job was respected. Why? Because of what he did for those who had no power. Job was a righteous and upright man. He took care of those who were helpless. And that's what gave him this wonderful reputation. And I think he really enjoyed that. I mean, that was wisdom. That was doing God's work. God was working through Job. Verse 18, "Then I said, I shall die in my nest and multiply my days as the sand. My root is spread out to the waters, and the dew lies all night on my branch. My glory is fresh within me, and my bow is renewed in my hand." He's saying there that he was filled with hope. Yet he looked forward to the future with great hope. His children would move on after him, that his branch would grow up, that his glory was fresh within him, that his bow was renewed in his hand. He was a man filled with hope. He was self-confident, unfortunately. And that's the great danger when we are highly respected, when God is blessing our life, that we become somewhat self-confident. There's a danger in that. Verse 21, "Men listened to me and waited and kept silence for my counsel. After my words, they did not speak again, and my speech settled on them as dew. They waited for me as for the rain, and they opened their mouth wide as for the spring rain. If I mocked at them, they did not believe it. And the light of my countenance they did not cast down. I chose the way for them and sat as chief. So I dwelt as a king in the army, as one who comforts mourners." That is to say, he was a wise counselor, a leader among the people, but he was also a little bit full of himself. And he was falling into one of the great dangers of Christian counsel. One of the great temptations is the temptation to desire to be a person who controls other people's lives. And that's always the danger in Christian counsel. Christian counsel is needed very much. We need to be encouraging one another. That's not something that a pastor only does, that a few people in the congregation. We're all to be counseling and encouraging one another, but we need to be careful that it doesn't become an attempt to control the lives of other people. Now, one of the lessons, I think, as we read through this chapter, for us as we look back and see the golden days in our lives is we need to remember that often the golden days were times of naive immaturity in our life. They were golden days because we were naive. We were a little immature. God hadn't yet had some lessons yet to teach us. And I think this is what Job was discovering here. Job goes on, though, to talk about the present distress. This is kind of a continuation of his ongoing lament. We'll finish it off quickly here. It's not a pretty sight. But now they mock at me, men younger than I, whose fathers I disdained to put with the dogs of my flock. Indeed, what profit is the strength of their hands to me? Their vigor has perished. They are gaunt from want and famine, fleeing late to the wilderness, desolate and waste. Who plucked mallow by the bushes and broom tree roots for their food. They were driven out from among men. They shouted at them as at a thief. They had to live in the clefts of the valleys, in caves of the earth and rocks, and among the bushes they brayed. Under the nettles they nestled. They were sons of fools, yes, sons of vile men. They were scourged from the land. This is kind of an interesting one here. He's talking to me about one of the great, when I read this section, I think of Job here as a man with great self-esteem, but he's looking at some other people and he's despising them. And there's been kind of a gospel of self-esteem that's been preached in our culture. And one of the recent discoveries at the psychological level was there's a problem with an excess of self-esteem. And that is that we begin to despise other people. And so Job here was despising some other men. Now, admittedly, these are ne'er-do-wells. They're men of no reputation and of no particular gifts or abilities, but still he's despising them, and that's one of the great dangers of self-esteem, because that we use that as a license to mistreat other people when we have an excess of self-esteem, and that seemed to be where Job was right at this moment. But Job goes on. He speaks of how he is being attacked by these people. And now I am their taunting song, verse 9. Yes, I am their byword. They abhor me and they keep far from me. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. Because he has loosed my bowstring and afflicted me, they have cast off restraint before me. At my right hand the rabble rises. They push away my feet. They raise against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path. They promote my calamity. They have no helper. They come as broad breakers. Under the ruinous storm they roll along. He's talking here about waves, I guess. Waves of the ocean, storm driven. Terrors are turned upon me. They pursue my honor as the wind, and my prosperity has passed like a cloud. And now my soul is poured out because of my plight. Oh, wait, that's the next section. But we see here that he's being attacked by these people who are not righteous, and he's really upset by it. But more than that, he's become quite discouraged. Let's read that in verse 16. And now my soul is poured out because of my plight. The days of affliction take hold of me. My bones are pierced in me at night. My gnawing pains take no rest. By great force my garment is disfigured. It binds me about as the collar of my coat. He has cast me into the mire, and I have become like dust and ashes. The picture of discouragement. That's where Job is. But worse than that, Job's all alone, or he feels that way. Verse 20, I cry out to you, God, but you do not answer me. I stand up and you regard me, but you have become cruel to me. With the strength of your hand you oppose me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride on it. You spoil my success, for I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living. Job is feeling, I'm estranged even from God at this point. Even God doesn't pay any attention to me anymore. Doesn't listen to me. But notice the good thing that's going on. What's he doing in spite of that? He's crying out to God. Keep crying out to God, even when it seems like God isn't listening. Job has it right. You just keep crying out. He's going to speak his mourning here at the end of the chapter. Surely he would not stretch out his hand against a heap of ruins if they cry out when he destroys it. Have I not wept for him who is in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? Would not God do the same, he's saying. But when I looked for evil, good, evil came to me, and when I waited for light, then came darkness. My heart is in turmoil and cannot rest. Days of affliction confront me. I go about mourning, but not in the Son. I stand in the assembly and cry out for help. I'm a brother of jackals and a companion of ostriches. My skin grows black and falls from me. My bones burn with fever. My harp is turned to mourning, and my flute to the voice of those who weep. That's the end, incidentally, of his lament that has had multiple verses throughout this whole section, and there he finally ends it. What happens when the bottom falls out in your life? You see, what's left then, that's what we really are. When the bottom falls out, when everything is taken away, we discover who we really are by what is left. And that's when God can often do his greatest work. Well, let's just finish off with this last chapter here, verse 31, which speaks to us about the measure of a righteous man. Chapter 31, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? For what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? A covenant with our eyes, that we not be involved in either lust or in coveting. And that is, I think, something needed very much in this day of materialism, in this day of lust and pornography. One of the most important messages, especially for single people, is the need for a covenant with our eyes. That we not allow our eyes to get out of whack and start looking at things that we shouldn't be looking at. If I had walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed on honest scales, that God may know my integrity. If my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another eat. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. He's talking here about honesty, about being very forthright about who we are as people before God. And he's saying, God, I want to be honest before you, and I want to take the consequences of my sins. But notice he is coming to God in his integrity. And that's very important, that we come to God in our integrity, that we don't run from God. Even if there is some sin in our life, we need to take that sin to God, not run from him. Next is the issue of purity in verse 9. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another, and let others bow down over her. For that would be wickedness, yes, it would be iniquity, deserving of judgment. For that would be a fire that consumes the destruction, and it would root out all my increase. Some people think that impurity is something which is a right of a person who's wealthy. He's saying, on the contrary, it destroys whatever possessions you have. It starts a fire within your body, within your life, that will destroy, will consume everything you have if you are involved in impurity. He goes on, though. He says, what about justice? If I have despised the cause of my male or female servant when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? Did not the same one fashion us in the womb? Here is, incidentally, the basis for the principle of equality before God, which is in our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution as well. Equality before God is based on these verses. And it's these two questions in verse 15 that describe this, which is the basis for what justice ought to be and for how we ought to think justly. Did not he who made me in the womb make them? That's the basis for equality before God. God made all of us. Also, this, interestingly enough, this is one of the great problems with evolution. It perverts justice in the sense that it removes the basis for equality. Whereas our basis for equality is that we were all created by God. Verse 16, if I have kept the poor from their desire, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten my morsel by myself so that the fatherless could not eat of it, but from my youth I reared him as a father, and from my mother's womb I guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me, and if he has not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless when I saw I had help in the gate, then let my arm fall from my shoulder, let my arm be torn from the socket, for the destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of his magnificence I cannot endure. So he's saying, the poor need their justice, and I deserve destruction. I deserve suffering. if I am not righteous, if I am not taking care of those who are poor. So if we have wealth, who is it for? Is it for my pleasure? Is that why God gives me wealth? No, God gives me wealth so that other people may enjoy it. So he is a friend to the poor. But more than that, he goes on to talk about trusting in riches, one of the great dangers today. If I have made gold my hope, or said to find gold, you are my confidence, if I have rejoiced because my wealth was great and because my hand had gained much, if I have observed the sun when it shines and the moon moving in brightness so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity deserving of judgment, for I have denied God who is above. So we are not to trust in our riches. We are not to bless the hand which has acquired these things for us. That's not what we are to be about. We're not to be about acquisitiveness. Verse 29, the issue of abusing power, verses 29 and following. If I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted myself up when evil found him. Isn't it interesting how politicians, when they get in power, oftentimes try to destroy all of their opponents as kind of the opening work of their administration? Very dangerous. It's not just. It's not right. Indeed, I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse on his soul. If the men of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with his meat? But no sojourner had to lodge in the street, for I have opened my doors to the traveler. If I have covered my transgressions as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom, you know, that's one of the great problems with our politicians today, cover-ups. He's saying, if I've done it, because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of the families, so that I kept silence and did not go out of the door, oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bind it on me like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. That is, as we submit to God's authority, then we can use the authority, the power we have received here on earth properly. We can do that only as we submit to God's authority, as we recognize ourselves as being accountable to him. That's what Job's saying. Write an account of all my sins, and I'll wear it on my back. I'll wear it as a placard for everyone to see. I'm accountable to God. I'm accountable to God. Finally, he ends up here. If my land cries out against me and its furrows weep together, if I have eaten its fruit without money or caused its owners to lose their lives, then let thistles grow instead of wheat and weeds instead of barley. That is to say, he's saying, if I have corrupted the land, as we read through the Old Testament law, this is one of the lessons you learn, is that one of the reasons they received the law of Moses was so that they would not corrupt the promised land that they were going into. And as they disobeyed the law, they corrupted that land, and the land, as it were, cast them out into captivity. God actually drew them out of that land into captivity because they had defiled the land. And so it is with us. We need to be careful not to defile that inheritance which God has given us. And then finally, hear the closing phrase, the words of Job are ended. He's done talking. He's going to be listening. Now he'll have a few more little things to say, but he's done talking, and we've heard what Job had to say in the last of his discourses. Next week we'll hear what Elihu has to say, who is actually far wiser than the other three friends, is not criticized. In fact, there's some who think that Elihu is the one who wrote this book. So next week, Elihu...